Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, we're confident we're going to be able to have a pretty good show here. Anytime you're looking at the second week of July, it's not exactly like the tree of content is plentiful to pick from, but we've got some great questions, some good buy or sell, and then a decent amount of stuff that we'll be able to draw upon from your recent travels regarding recruiting and just to get a little bit of a national perspective as far as what's going on that that end of college football. So always excited to be able to do a podcast, and part of that excitement is based off me being able to talk to somebody like yourself and be able to talk about Florida State football, and also to be able to pair with somebody like Louisiana Hot Sauce. So I want to begin the podcast by thanking them for their longstanding support, thanking you, the listener, for just a amazing amount of feedback that you've been able to give them, both in in-store purchases and interactions on social media, and just a marketing campaign for them that's been very successful, and something I'd like to thank you guys for, as always. So, Bud, let's jump into this Nolcast made possible by Louisiana Hot Sauce and get right into it.
LHS, Louisiana Hot Sauce. Absolutely, man. Okay, so, Ingram, the first topic of the night. Vegas came out. This was at the Westgate. They came out with the betting lines for their games of the year, which include, obviously, games in the future. And nine Florida State games were on that list, which is... I mean, it's got to be damn near the most of any team, right? I don't think that nine Bama games are on that list. It shows a couple things, and we'll go over the lines here in a second. We can talk about, you know, which one would you most want to play on FSU and which one would you most want to play against Florida State. But my initial takeaway was, damn, FSU's playing nine games that there are lines available on? Or eight? What the heck? That right there tells you how tough this schedule is. They don't put out lines for games where FSU is going to be favored by like 20, right? You know, so there's no line for the Wake game or the Samford game or the Northern Illinois game. And I didn't see one for BC, but...
I'm kind of surprised there wasn't one for BC, to be honest. That's a game that we've kind of talked about as maybe a game that is an under-the-radar challenge for Florida State. I don't mean to take us in another direction with what we're talking about, but that in and of itself was slightly surprising that the number wasn't nine.
I mean, eight games that you have lines on, people are like, FSU doesn't have eight losable games. And when we say losable, we don't mean games that they will lose. We mean games that they could potentially lose. I think they got nine of them, not eight. The Syracuse line, by the way, I guess we'll start there. 9.5. Florida State's not even a double-digit favorite at Syracuse.
It would be interesting if we were able to cut out the 10 to 12-minute conversation that we did a couple months ago with guaranteed wins and somehow pair this in an audio format for the listener. But no, it doesn't surprise me. And if you go back to that conversation, I remember looking at that game. The number is surprising to me that it's only 9.5. I would have thought that maybe it was a little bit more, but not, I don't know, maybe 13.5 or something like that would have been more appropriate in my opinion.
That's totally fair.
But in the Syracuse game, like a noon kickoff at Syracuse, it's a little bit of a strange setting and not one that I would think that is necessarily indicative of Florida State going in there. I mean, I remember noting that when we were talking about the guaranteed games. It's a game that you could see Florida State sleepwalking through the first couple of quarters.
I hope they don't sleepwalk through this because, look, they're coming off the Samford game, and they have Northern Illinois on deck. It's not a weather game. Syracuse, among the teams in the Power 5, plays one of the closest offensive styles to what Florida State's going to play. They both run sort of a Baylor framework, although FSU runs the ball a lot more. They still run that tempo that really stresses out defenses. They're a lot like Florida State in every way except for talent, right? I still am going to have that in my sort of auto win thing. I know 9.5 implies that it's not. But it does indicate that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that is more of a losable game than I'm thinking. I might be swayed over to your side on that, man. We also have, on the other side of things, Florida State is a 10-point underdog in Doak to Clemson.
So, I mean, I think that's about right. So you put, what, 3.5 for Florida State because of where the game's being hosted? Maybe 4. I know you're better about that than I am as far as knowing exactly where Vegas values a particular environment for what will likely be a night game is probably a 4-point plus. Is Clemson 2 touchdowns better than Florida State right now? Particularly when you look at the kids that decided to stay and the composition of that roster, I don't have a problem with coming to that conclusion.
No, I don't either. How about 5.5 at Notre Dame and 5.5 at Miami? Any of those strike you?
So the original line on Miami, this is the one that's moved a decent amount from what that first, the small betting maximums that we talked about a couple weeks ago. Wasn't this originally maybe 9 or something like that?
Yeah, it was. I know it was over 7 because we initially said, yeah, take Florida State. And anything over a touchdown in this.
Okay. So I feel like that one's moved the most. I think that's getting to be more appropriate. I'd still kind of like Florida State at 5.5. And again, you're much more expertise in walking through this this area. It's not something that I actively gamble. But I would like Florida State up until maybe 3.5 until Miami. Unless you saw that move more than another 2 points, I would continue to kind of like Florida State if you made me place a bet on that one.
I think I agree. I really don't want to take that either way, to be honest. I did want Florida State at over a touchdown, obviously, down there. They're laying 3 at NC State, 3.5 at Louisville. Boston College, no line. They're given 5.5 at in Doak to Florida. They're given 6.5 to Va Tech. Ingram, let me ask you this. What is the one game that you want to play against Florida State? Not like in your heart you want to play against Florida State, but for money-making purposes, what's the one game you want to play against Florida State, and what's the one game that you want to play on Florida State?
So the against one is pretty easy. If you tell me that I get to choose a game on the road in a place that Florida State's historically challenged, been challenged when going to, and the fact that you're looking at that possibly being sandwiched between two national TV games. I mean, it's almost certainly going to be with the Notre Dame games an announced 7:30 time on NBC. Clemson, particularly depending on how Florida State plays, is, like we just referenced, is very likely to be a national night game. I would, if you're making me put money on a game against Florida State, I would push everything towards the middle of the table with the NC State game.
That's a great pick, to be honest. And I know they're only getting 3, but it wouldn't surprise me to see NC State favored in that game, or more like a pick, more like a pick 'em come game time. They've got the best receivers in the conference and the best quarterback in the conference. Pretty experienced DBs and linebackers. Obviously, they lost a ton on defensive line, but I think their offense is going to score a ton of points again. And you saw a lot of teams last year not be able to really get any kind of pressure on Finley. So I totally get that pick. I'm going to go the week later. I'm going to go with FSU at Notre Dame. That is the third consecutive all-out war they're going to have to play. And they have to host Clemson. They go to NC State. They got to turn right back around. No bye week on this or anything, and go to Notre Dame. I get Notre Dame, and I get to lay under a touchdown. I think Notre Dame should be favored by a full touchdown or more. So 5.5, I'm taking the Irish there in that one. Really like their defense this year, and I think they're just as talented as FSU and probably more physically developed, given that they have the coaching staff continuity there. FSU kind of taking a year off from strength conditioning last year was not a plus. Glad they're back on it now, but you can't go back and redo 2017. Let's flip it. What's the one game you really want to bet Florida State, given these current lines?
Yeah, this one I feel pretty confident about too. I would take the Florida game at this point until that line moved closer to a touchdown. I feel fairly confident about that and think that Florida State's roster is a touchdown better than Florida, particularly at home.
All right, that was my pick, and I agree with you. look, Florida, I think, lacks defensive depth quite a bit, and towards the end of the year, they could be pretty worn down. I don't know what their offense is going to look like. I actually like some of their offensive pieces a lot. I think they're going to be very good at receiver, assuming those transfers are going to be eligible. I think Jordan Scarlett's a nice back. Their offensive line, I think, quietly got a lot better last year, and everybody's back for them. But I have no idea who the hell they're going to play at quarterback, or if any of those guys even fit what Mullen wants to do. I would lay a touchdown on a neutral site against Florida with FSU. I would absolutely lay a 5.5 in Doak. So that's my pick as well. If I have to pick another one, because we can't do copy and picks, I might be tempted to back up my words and take FSU and lay under a touchdown, or excuse me, under 10 at Syracuse.
Yeah, I would say that's would probably be number two for me. Miami would probably be number three at this point. So interesting look, and interesting look at some of those lines that have moved from the initial numbers that were first put out.
All right, what do we got here now? Let me ask you a question, Anger. And this is, you can take this as just for this year or implications for longer term or however you want to take this. But I posed this question on Tomahawk Nation earlier. So FSU is an underdog in three games. And for those of you all who don't know, upset means when an underdog wins. It's not the lower seeded team. It's not the team that you didn't think would win wins. It's not an opinion term. It is literally the team which was the underdog on the Vegas line. If they win, that's an upset. So there are three games, based on the current lines, that Florida State, if they win, it would be an upset. Clemson, at Notre Dame, and at Miami. Just so we can set these terms and so people can't be like, oh, well, I don't consider that an upset. It's not a subjective thing. It's, if the line is the line, then it's an upset. If they're the favored, they're not an upset. Okay, cool. Got that? So let me ask you this. If FSU this year can pull one upset of the three, that means they lose the other two. Clemson, at Notre Dame, Miami. Which one do you think would be the best game to pull the upset for FSU?
You could certainly make an argument for Miami, and I would understand that. I would lean... This is tough, but there's, if you want to make the argument for Miami, you can. If you want to make the argument for Clemson, I think you very much can. I think you in your mind, you may prove yourself wrong with a conversation that we just had about some of the challenges that are on the schedule, but you can tell yourself that if you beat Clemson, you're really two games up in the Atlantic. You have a real hard time finding a manner that... that maybe sees you give up that lead. That maybe you winning Clemson means that you win the Atlantic, and even if you lose to Miami, that you might have another chance at beating them and a chance to go to the college football playoff. So I can certainly understand what winning at Miami would mean for recruiting, and I can appreciate anybody that looks at those and chooses that game. But at the same time, I think there's some significant arguments that can be made for the Clemson victory, and one of those is that you may in fact secure yourself another chance to play Miami at the end of the year.
I totally get that point. That's a point of a lot of our readers made as well. I'm of the mindset that, look, even if you beat Clemson and you lose to Miami, you lose Notre Dame, I still think you're losing the third game in conference. I don't give Florida State much of a chance of going undefeated against Syracuse, Louisville, NC State, Wake, Boston College, that slate. You know what I mean? Like the chance that they run that with a zero in the loss column to me is very low. So in my opinion, if you beat Clemson, I still don't like your chances of winning the Atlantic all that much. I mean, clearly I like them a lot better than if you lose to Clemson, but it's just tough. I think... for recruiting purposes, preventing Miami from getting a winning streak over U of two games, because they've only, it's only one. And I think they've only won three times in the last 14 years.
And it'll be a big weekend for them. They'll have tons of visitors. And you could make an argument that maybe you're doing the same thing. Maybe that Willie would have the same chance to go down there and do the same thing to Richt that Jimbo more or less did to Randy Shannon in one of the more pivotal games during his tenure. I absolutely get it. I do.
No doubt, man. I think that's why I picked Miami. Now, if you're telling me the reason why FSU beats Clemson is because Clemson ended up not being as good as we think they are, and that Clemson probably goes on to lose two ACC games, then yeah, then I could see Clemson being the pick because the chance you win the league is greater. But I just have a really hard time seeing FSU lose fewer than two ACC games, even if they beat Clemson. So,
all right, bud. So every once in a while, and we try to do this all the time, but every once in a while, our listeners are richly rewarded for listening to the podcast. So about 6 or 7 weeks ago, it might have been a little bit more, we mentioned both of us had kind of heard from different people that Virginia Tech was in a place to have a exceptionally tough offseason. Now, I'll be completely honest with you. Some of the things that we heard about have come true. Some of them were outside of the rumors that were surrounding that program. But one of the things that were posed to us was a kid that was dismissed from the program yesterday. So it's been an exceptionally tough offseason for Virginia Tech. And it's been an exceptionally tough offseason for Virginia Tech, particularly on the defensive side of the ball.
Mook Reynolds is now gone. They're starting nickelback. Whew, boy, man, Virginia Tech has lost a lot on defense. They really have. If you pull up Andy Bitter, who is an excellent, I think he's still with Roanoke Times. I don't know if he's going to the Athletic or not. He's got a list now of guys who they've lost just this offseason, and it's pretty incredible. Okay, so look who's gone from Virginia Tech's defense here. Tim Settle, who was a former elite-level defensive tackle recruit, early NFL. Linebacker Andrew Motupuka, I don't know how to say that name, he graduated. Tremaine Edmonds, that was the brother who was not as good. He went pro. Mook Reynolds, like we just said, dismissed. Tremaine was the really good one. Terrell was just the older brother. Tremaine Edmonds was the best defensive player in the league last year. So extremely excited that he is gone from an FSU perspective. Corner Brandon Faison graduated. Corner Greg Stroman graduated. Corner Adonis Alexander failed out. So now they have lost Mook Reynolds, Adonis Alexander, who else? Oh, Galen Hall, their defensive coordinator, gone because he had an affair on a recruiting trip, allegedly. Also, Jeremy Webb, their top JUCO corner, came in and either had a pre-existing Achilles injury or suffered one very quickly during workouts. Sometimes you'll see that with JUCO kids so that the insurance, you know, can cover that injury since it happened on your campus type thing. That's a big deal, man. They've lost a ton on defense. And Bud Foster, I think this might be enough to where we need to reassess where Virginia Tech ranks in terms of the difficulty level of their games. Now, I know we did this probably, 2 months ago, I think? We ranked them in order of the 10 most difficult to easiest games in FSU schedule.
Yeah, somewhere 6 to 8 weeks ago.
I think we should redo this. I'll go first. I'm kind of springing this on you if I want to give you time to gather your thoughts here. My toughest is Clemson. Next would be at Notre Dame. Then at Miami of Florida. Then at NC State. Then at Louisville. Then Boston College. Then UF. Then Virginia Tech. Then at Cuse, and then finally hosting Wake. This is an important change for me because I think prior that I had Virginia Tech before, like as more difficult than the Boston College UF group. And now I moved them back two slots. I think Vatech now is an easier game than the UF. And I think it's an easier game than Boston College, especially with the timing. This level of inexperience on the Hokies defense has increased my optimism or increased my win expectation with Florida State in that opening game.
It's I think it's very appropriate to re-rank, and ours will be a little bit different than they always have been, but I think we always had the top three as the same, maybe the top four. If we haven't, I'll make it that way now. I would honestly at this point, I might have, and this I may just be serial underranking Louisville. I did it in the first time we did it too. I would have BC in front of Louisville, and I would still have Virginia Tech as a slightly more likely game to lose than Florida. Other than that, we're pretty much mirror each other at this point. So for me, we did, absolutely. Clemson, Notre Dame, Miami, NC State, BC, Louisville, Virginia Tech, UF, Cuse, Wake.
That'll work. I mean, I think that's pretty solid. Saying in the ACC, Bill Connolly's ACC previews are now coming out. I think he has three or four done so far. And because I work with him, I know what the order will be. So that's kind of cool. The rest of y'all do not, but four of them are up so far. And one thing I noticed is that Florida State doesn't get to play three of the four worst ACC teams. They don't get to play Duke. They don't get to play Virginia. And they don't get to play UNC. They do get to play Cuse. So they only get to play one of the bottom four. That just further underscores, and I know ESPN's had it at number one and Phil Steele's had it at number one in terms of schedule difficulty, but this thing is no joke, man. Let me ask you a question. What do you think Florida State's record would be if it had Miami schedule or if it had Florida schedule? And just for some context, I can pull this up. Charleston Southern. I feel pretty good about that one. Kentucky in the swamp. Colorado State in the swamp. Tennessee in Neyland. Florida goes on the road then next to Mississippi State. Then they host LSU for what seems like the millionth year in a row. But I know Florida fans save the emails. That is because of the hurricane. Got it. Then Florida goes to Vanderbilt. Ooh. Then they play Georgia off a bye week, and they're an underdog of like 16 points. Phew, yikes. Then Missouri comes to Gainesville. Then South Carolina comes to Gainesville. Then Idaho comes to Gainesville. And then they go to Tallahassee. So if you flipped the games and you put FSU instead of Florida in those.
I have a hard time seeing you lose more than two games.
I think I would say, yeah, I think I would be more in that 9-3, 10-2 camp. And currently, as you know, I think I'm in that 8-4, 9-3 camp for FSU. So I would feel very confident that FSU would have at least a full win better against Florida's schedule.
Where do you see, so Georgia, most likely a loss.
Yeah, I think Georgia would be tough. And then I think, okay, so if you like them at 10-2, the non-locks would be South Carolina at Mississippi State, which I think is going to be a really good team, and LSU, right? I mean, to me, Missouri in the swamp and Florida and Vanderbilt on the road are our locks for an FSU-level team. And so is Kentucky in the swamp. So can you go 3-1 against LSU at Mississippi State, host South Carolina, and host UF? I think you can. Florida's schedule might legitimately be two wins easier for a team like FSU. All right, let's hit Miami's schedule real quickly here. LSU... we play LSU again. Great. LSU in, is that in Dallas, I think?
That is a neutral site game in Jerry World, I'm pretty sure. So I'll do it so that you don't have to read both of these. LSU, then you bring in our favorite program in Savannah State, travel to Toledo. I want to reiterate that you're traveling to Toledo to play at noon on September 15th, traveling to Toledo.
Where do you think you fly into from Miami if you're going to Toledo?
I imagine you're probably flying into, you'd get a direct flight to Columbus. Toledo is in the Northwest Corridor, I believe.
What airlines fly out of Toledo?
You're flying into Detroit. That's what you're doing.
Oh.
Yeah, either okay. Detroit or Cleveland.
as a Delta guy, I was hoping I could fly into Minneapolis because Minneapolis actually has the PGA simulator lounge. And if you guys, if you have the Chase Reserve card, you can hit the simulator lounge and you get simulator time and a really nice putting green and two drinks. So pro tip on that one. But okay, Ingram, I'm going to have Toledo in the win column despite the fact that it is on the road. What's next?
I just want to take another second to point out that they're playing Toledo at noon and traveling to Toledo.
Is it a home and home, or is it a two for one, or is it a true home and home?
No, I think it's just a one and one.
That's embarrassing.
Kind of similar to what they did with Appalachian State. So interesting, Miami. Then they host Florida International. Then they host North Carolina. Then they host Florida State, which doesn't do a whole lot for this conversation. Turn around and travel to Charlottesville. Win. Travel to Boston College.
That is a clear toss-up. Ooh, that's a Friday night game, isn't it?
The 26th, yes it is.
Oh, but they're off a bye.
They are off
a bye. They
got to
be. Yeah.
They are off a bye. They host Duke, travel to Atlanta to play Georgia Tech, to Blacksburg in November, which possibly could be more challenging than our game in September, and then they host Pitt to end the season.
Okay, so I have that at 8 wins and excuse me, 7 wins and 5 toss-ups. So I think Miami's schedule is actually a little bit harder than Florida's.
Yeah, it is. It is more difficult. Florida's schedule is really something special, but I think this is probably a full win. Better, I would say. Oh, the East is laughable, and Florida just happens to have a favorable confluence of events with some of the games on their schedule that maybe historically you would think is more challenging. But yeah, it's crap.
So with Miami, we're gonna say we're confident that FSU would be a full win better. With Florida, we're kind of leaning towards two wins
full back. Wins, which is a bigger statement than maybe it first sounds to some of y'all out there. So,
man, Dan Mullen better win 9 games against the – he better go 9-3.
Better get that ball rolling, Coach, because Lord knows some of the fan base is starting to already starting to worry maybe a little bit about where that ship's ultimately headed.
So that was interesting, by the way. Did you see this thing I tweeted from the Nolcast account?
Which tweet are you referring to?
It was the tweet. I took a look at the Florida Gators season list, right? Which is basically what have the Gators done since current recruits were in middle school.
Yes, I did see this. For those of you out there, both Bud and I operate the Nolcast account kind of independently of each other sometimes, and it makes for a good juxtaposition sometimes of what's out there. But I did see what you put out there and thought that was particularly interesting and maybe only slightly humbling to those in Gainesville.
So you're Florida. You're trying to go out to the West Coast and pull kids. Since these kids entered middle school, here's what Florida's done. 11-2. Awesome. That was 2012. By the way, you got to feel pretty old when kids entered middle school in 2012. But 11-2, 4-8, 7-5, 10-4, 9-4, 4-7. No conference titles. 1 BCS bowl. 2 years where you just flat out missed a bowl. None of that's impressive. Their SEC record in that time is buoyed only because the East is so weak. I mean, they're 18 losses and 30 wins. They're 30-18 in the league. I mean, that could be a reason why they're struggling somewhat in recruiting, because kids don't really look at the UF logo and think that it's different.
This happens to every program after a period of time where they suffer a little bit of a streak of not playing to the performance that they think they should. That ultimately, when you look back at Jimbo Fisher's time, is why you have to appreciate him and note that he brought a program back to the top when it had kind of started to wane in its relevance and maybe at a point in time when some didn't think it was possible. And Florida's been at a point in time where The logo is not special. Tim Tebow is not somebody that kids know of or recognize. Percy Harvin, for all intents and purposes, is a distant memory for the kids that play high school football right now. It is something that Florida is going to have to deal with, and it's something that we talked about in the past podcast, that just walking in with a, you know, as coaches say, walking in with that logo on your chest is not something that's going to knock down doors for you in recruiting, and is not something that's going to necessarily guarantee you a win in recruiting trail when maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago you were able to draw upon a base that had a much more fresh memory of Florida being a dominant football program.
Well said, man. By the way, since you brought up Jimbo, and we try not to talk a whole lot of Jimbo on this program because some people just keep dwelling on it and we're over it. I just did some quick math in my head here. Jimbo went 6-1 against Florida. Excuse me, 7-1. Do you want to take a guess at what the record was of the UF teams Jimbo beat? 49-39. That's like almost perfectly 7-5.
Even with 2 4-8 seasons mixed in, huh?
Well, because they had an 8-5, a 7-6, a 7-5, and then McElwain had a 10-4 and a 9-4.
Yeah, that's right.
They won the East twice, man. That's what they brought him there to do. Just saying.
Even with 2 4-8 seasons mixed in, huh?
Well played. All right, let's have a little recruiting chatter. So, a lot of people have asked us about this tonight. We're not going to go too deep into this simply because these recruiting rankings updates are still ongoing, and I don't want to say something that is no longer relevant 24 hours later. I will speak to the kids who were at the opening. It looks like none of FSU's kids at the opening got big-time bumps or drops, which I think is perfectly in line with how they performed and how they are as recruits. Sam Howell is still barely outside the top 100. I think he moved up 2 spots. He's now the number 3 quarterback in the nation. Bo Nix passed him. I got no problem with that. Bo Nix is just give a passer, a little bit better build, more athletic. Cool. No big deal there. I think Dent dropped 3 spots. It was not a reflection of his performance. It was just a couple guys at other positions passing him up. Who else? Quayshon Fuller actually jumped up about 25 spots into the top 200. Great to see him perform well out there now that he's healthy. The shoulder's looking better. He's feeling better. And he told me that he had really kind of reconnected with Florida State and had like a 4-hour phone call with Snyder one night, by the way, which I'm still going to write this up on and put it on Tomahawk. But it was interesting to hear him say that. He's like, yeah, man, he really kind of took care of all my concerns. So interesting there. I haven't seen any kind of update for Renardo Green yet. As you all know, I don't think that he's a guy who automatically deserves 4 stars, and I don't think a lot of the Florida State fans who are claiming that he does would be doing so if he was wearing somebody else's laundry. We have a tendency as a fan base, and all fan bases do this, to just assume that if the staff took a kid early, well, clearly they wouldn't do that unless he should be a 4 star. And, you know, I probably disagree with the staff on this. I think that there's a couple kids in his class that they did not need to take early, and they could have secured commitments from later in the cycle. 2 kids who I hope to see rankings bumps for from 247, Dante Lucas, who apparently looked really good at the Rivals event, I was told, and Travis Jay, who doesn't do a whole lot of camps, but in my opinion is an excellent football player. Those are 2 early commits that I really did like from the staff. We saw big rankings drops for Maurice Goolsbee and Jaleel McCray. I don't have a problem with either of those. McCray, if he stays healthy, maybe we'll see him go back up some. But you know, he's got to put together a successful year on the field and really stay healthy and show that promise that he once showed. Florida State clearly thinks that he can. I was impressed with his athleticism and drills this spring, but he had a wrist or an arm injury, so he wasn't actually doing contact stuff. And then Goolsbee, you know, I'm not convinced he's an FSU quality player, so we'll have to see how that plays out in the fall. But, you know, I still think that they are on track to have an excellent class. And we'll be talking more about the upcoming Saturday Night Live recruiting event on a future episode. That is July 28th. They want to get a lot of fans out there for that. I'm not about to drop that list of who I know is coming quite yet on a podcast because it's going to be out of date as soon as this thing publishes because kids RSVP multiple places and they constantly change their minds. If you want to see a good list for that, we have one on Tomahawk Nation. You can check. I'm focusing just on the biggest stars and only putting kids on there who have either they've told me personally, their coaches told me, another player's told me that they're riding with them, or a source in FSU staff has told me. So I'm not just putting kids. It's not a wish list. It's a list of kids who have actually told me they're coming. So, you know, that is hopefully useful to you as a reader.
All right, bud. We'll look forward to continuing to follow the recruiting process. And obviously the July 28th event is something that we've talked about. And we'll do our best to both preview and review that event as it comes. With that, why don't we pause here real briefly to thank our friends Madison Social or For the Table Restaurant Group for what they've been able to do with us historically, and also take this time to remind people again of the event that we are doing with them from 2 to 4 on the Sunday prior to the Labor Day kick of the Virginia Tech game.
That's right, man. It's going to be a blast. We know we had a couple hundred folks out at the last one. This one is the game day bar crawl 2 to 4 on Sunday, the day before FSU kicks off the season. Lethal Simplicity meets the Nolcast. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be the weekend bar crawl. It's us. It's Madison Social. It's Township. It's Central. It's For the Table Restaurant Group. It's Proof Brewing Company. It's awesome. By the way, here's what you're going to get. You're going to pre-order your tickets on madisonsocial.com/gameday-bar-crawl. That's madisonsocial.com/gameday-bar-crawl. I'll also put a link to that in our Twitter page because that's a lot to type in. So look at the Twitter page and we'll be able to hook you up with that. Bar crawl will include a Proof Madison Social. It's kind of, I like the wording on that, at Madison Social. A Proof Mango Wit at Central, and a Proof Warpath IPA with a special Nolcast treatment at Township. And we'll have more details on that soon, as well as a Nolcast Punting is Bunting koozie that will be perfect for game day the next day. That is awesome. Your friends will be very jealous if you get that very cool Punting is Bunting koozie. I don't believe we have any new shirts coming from that. We may have a different shirt to sell later on. So come out 2 to 4. Hang out with Ingram and I, hang out with all the Noles. And then, you know what is later that night? You get a chance to watch Miami lose to LSU. That's a Sunday night game. I didn't even realize that. That'd be pretty fun as well. So, anyway, get those tickets. Get them early. They will sell out, so we definitely want to make sure everybody gets in. We want to have an accurate head count so we know how many koozies we need to have on hand, and we'll see you all there.
Bud, we'll transfer to some questions that we've recently had posed to us, the first of which is, who will be the top three receivers in terms of yardage this year?
We might agree on this. I'm thinking it will have to be Nooney, one, assuming that he's healthy and he looks like on Twitter and Instagram that he is. Two, I'm going to go Terry. And three, I'm going to go DJ Matthews.
I'd like to disagree with you for content's sake, but I don't. I would say that the only thing that I might have is that from overall production standpoint, Terry might end up being your number one. And not to say that you were necessarily ranking people on production, but I think that those three are the three that I would go with. And from an end of year production standpoint, I might look at Terry, Murray, and Matthews in that order.
All right, Ingram, let's go with this one. Hello from Japan. Nice. It's a shame they don't have any Louisiana hot sauce here. Indeed. Well, maybe we could ship some. I don't know. Was watching old college ball games when I got to thinking, what kind of odds/point spread would we see if the 2009 Gators, the team that got trounced by Bama in the SEC championship game, played the 2014 Florida State Seminoles on a neutral field? Love the work you guys put out. And I don't know how to say his name because it's in Japanese. But that's still really cool. All right. So to refresh here, this I think is a really fun spinoff on the popular question, who would win the FSU 2014 2013 team or the 2008 Gators team, to which I think it's pretty clear FSU would beat them because of the completeness of the team and the passing game. Also, I think FSU's corners on that team were a lot better than what Ford had, personally. Now, this is a little different. I think the 14 FSU team was more talented, but as we knew, it didn't always play up to its talent level. There seemed to be kind of a continuity issue there. That was really the first team that was entirely Jimbo's recruits. And I personally believe that they had kind of realized that Jimbo was not going to lay down the law and cut anybody, and that he would yell and scream a lot, but not actually follow through on discipline. And so that's, in my opinion, when some of the slacking off really began, because the kids just realized he wouldn't actually do anything to them. That Florida team also had some level of dysfunction on it, certainly, but they were still pretty good. Ingram, I'm going to say something here I don't think FSU fans will like. I think 09 Florida beats 2014 FSU simply because of Tebow. And that team still had enough guys on defense that it was a pretty good team. I don't like, for 2014 FSU chances against them.
Was that the defense they were running, like a 3-3-5 or something like that? Florida's defense was unique and had a bunch of quality guys up front.
I'm pulling up their roster right here, but just so I don't misspeak, because if I misspeak on this, we're going to have Gator fans all in our mentions on Twitter.
And we do have a decent amount of Gator listeners, too. So thank you very, very much.
They like to hate listen. All right, that secondary was nasty. Joe Hayden, Will Hill, Major Wright, Ahmad Black, who actually was not that good, but whatever. He was pretty good, he was a name,
and he was a known quantity from the recruiting. Yeah. He was another piece.
And Janoris Jenkins as the other corner. Jelani Jenkins, Brandon Spikes were two of your backers. Jermaine Cunningham and Carlos Dunlap were your ends, and Jay Howard was your D-tackle. That's a pretty nasty defense, and Charlie Strong was still coordinating that defense, I believe. So, it was nasty. And then on offense, they had Riley Cooper. This offense had some guys who would go on to be arrested. Quite a few, actually. Let's look at this. We have Chris Rainey, Riley Cooper, the Pouncey twin, the Pouncey twin still, Carl Johnson, Marcus Gilbert, Aaron Hernandez. It might actually be a little bit easier for us to read the guys who did not. I don't want to speak incorrectly about somebody getting arrested. Yep, okay, he got popped for weed, so add him to the list. I think there's only three starters on Florida's offense from 2009 who have not been arrested. That's pretty wild, but I still think they're going to beat 2014 FSU. Ultimately, neither of those teams ended up winning a title.
Yeah, neither of those teams ended up winning a title. And in first look back, I thought that 2009 Florida was a little bit more dominant, but they were. They didn't play quite the series of last-minute games like Florida State did. But at the same time, I mean, it's a 10-point win over a Tennessee team that didn't blow you away. 10-point win at LSU, that's a bigger deal than I'm making it out. 3-point win the next week against Arkansas, I can see how that would happen. 10-point victory at Mississippi State. 10-point win against South Carolina. So they played some close games, but they were the two teams are very similar in the fact that they're wildly talented. A lot of kids, as we talk about. Maybe the quickest way to lose your roster is have a bunch of kids that have already made their money as far as the film that they've put out, but they're still stuck in college football. Certainly both of these two teams had that. And then both of these teams kind of had that, that same fate where they managed to continue to, eke out victories based off the talent. But once kind of the levee broke, now you could argue that Florida State's broke in more spectacular fashion as far as the score. You would also argue that while Jameis had one of his more embarrassing moments, he did not go to the sideline and start crying either. So, both teams, when the dam broke, it broke in pretty spectacular fashion in the manner in which they lost their game.
So if you actually roll back that CBS broadcast, you can actually see me in the crowd. I'm in the front row. I was still in law school back then, and you could see. He was crying. It was
what
bad.
A moment.
And guys were like pushing over water coolers and stuff, and slamming their hands into like the big crates of equipment, and they were just pretty typical reactions, except for the crying. That was not super typical.
No, it was not typical. I remember watching that. I called my best friend who was in the middle of some. He was in med school studying, and he was very much in the middle of a study session. I could tell that when I called him, and I'm like, "Are you watching this game?" He's like, "No, I'm studying for a massive exam." Kind of massively angry that I was calling him. I'm like, "Well, Tim Tebow's on the TV crying like a little girl, so you need to turn it on." And needless to say, his manner made a pretty quick shift at the idea of being able to take in such an event. So. It went up in flames. Both teams had a lot of flammable assets lying around them.
No doubt. Oh, hey, let's brag about something. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, listeners. June 2018 was the 8th consecutive month that we have doubled the previous year's month. So our June 2018 was more than double of June 2017. Just like May was double May, you know, April was double April. I'm going to stop counting back before I forget the order of the months. But
that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. And look, we've never been a small podcast by any means. Always been a product that's been well received. Obviously, we've been fortunate enough to grow significantly. Over the past year, really over the past 18 months, but that's amazing, and just want to thank all of you guys who listened, and also those of you who, you know, pointed out to your friends or, you know, suggest it to a fellow Florida State fan that you may know if you guys are, you know, trapped away on the other side of the country or something like that and don't necessarily get to get all that much Florida State content on your hands. So thank you very much to our listeners, and that's just an amazing stat.
Also, we'd like 5-star reviews on iTunes, and we will soon be on Google Podcasts, I believe. So, gotta get that figured out. But I don't know if you saw that or not. Seriously, here I have not mentioned this to Ingram, but now there's a Google Podcast in addition to Google Play Music. So we're gonna have to look into that and see what the benefits are. A couple more questions here. I've got some buyer sells, I guess, to get to. I had a question about the staff evaluations. The old staff was really high on the Grayson, Georgia kids. All of a sudden, all of them are blue chips going to Auburn and others. Is FSU being too selective with some of these players? It seems like the big SEC schools are jumping at their recruitments. So what are sometimes Taggart and co. find wrong with their skills at the next level? Always appreciate the insight and look forward to FSU football in 2 months. Well, I'm never going to bash somebody who takes the time to email us a question. You know, we love the feedback and the questions. But the premise on this one is just not right. FSU did not turn down the Grayson kids, at least not the good ones. They lost the coaches who had the relationships at Grayson. Recruiting is about relationships. The kids didn't fall in love with the school. They fell in love with some of the coaches who were here. So when those coaches stopped recruiting him, that turned those kids off to Florida State. I think Florida State liked those Grayson kids a lot, a whole lot. They just didn't have any traction with them, and other schools have been recruiting them now for several years. So they're not going to get them. And Grayson is, of course, a big-time high school in Georgia. But anyway, that's what happened there with that. Like Wanya Morris, who is just awesome. I mean, kid just looks like a number one overall offensive tackle type dude. You know, at one point, he was an FSU commit, so, you know, certainly something that they miss badly. But they don't have nobody at FSU now has a relationship with that kid. It's a new staff. It's a new thing. It's not anything of where, like, FSU didn't like them and didn't offer. That's just not true. And you guys know that I would tell you if I didn't like some of the offers or some of the kids that they were taking. I already told you that earlier in the show, that there are some of these kids I don't think FSU needs to take quite so early in the year. So that's kind of my take
I would say that the old staff was real high on them. They were. The old staff also just stopped recruiting those kids, and they stopped recruiting a lot of people. So they were in a great place for Owen Popo. At one point in time, they were very, very close to securing a public commitment for him. And I'm talking about like summer of 2017. I'm not saying that would have stuck per se, but they were very, very close to securing a public commitment from him. And then just stopped calling what was maybe one of the best linebackers in the 2019 class for, I don't know, they went, people close to that kid have told me that Florida State went something like 80 days without formal contact with him. So, anyway, no, it didn't. I mean, I think the world of Andy Staples, I do. And I just am curious by some of the things that ended up in the final, the final print. So, I understand those things. That's, you can't go in and put a hatchet job on somebody, but the idea that Texas A&M was sitting on end and the Christmas tree was not but something that they wanted to have replaced. There were a lot of things. And again, that's not Andy Staples' job, isn't to go and find out, you know, who Jimbo's Christmas decorator and whether or not he's being honest with him. But I think there was some real Jimbo fiction woven into that article, just based off what he presented to the author.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we get a lot of Jimbo questions. We don't always answer all of the Jimbo questions just because it's Jimbo's not the head coach anymore. We certainly won't devote a full podcast to Jimbo Fisher. We will do like maybe I'm going to self-impose a rule here, bud, and you can argue with me if you want, but I don't really much want to talk about Jimbo Fisher past August 1st. Obviously, if Texas A&M goes 9-0 or something like that, or if Texas A&M goes 0-4, and there's an appropriate point in time for some point in us to do that, we will. If it's a point of reference based off what one staff is doing or a philosophy, we may. But we'll have a final Jimbo conversation at some point here in the next month, and it may take 5 minutes, it may take 25 minutes, but let's go ahead and put that to bed and leave it there at some point in time.
I'm fully on board with that. All right. So here's a question. Based on your suggestions last show and some related videos on YouTube, I watched the USF Navy game from 2016. And the Oregon-Nebraska game from 2017. In both games, Taggart's offense gets off to a blazing half or blazing start before hitting the skids in the second half, including scoring 0 against Nebraska after scoring 42 in the first half. Is this an issue of Taggart still learning how to adjust on the fly as a head coach when plan A stops working, or did I simply watch the wrong two games to make an adequate adjustment? Thanks for the content you guys put out. Keep up the good work. This is a great question, and it's something I've been wanting to address for a while. So I'm actually kind of, even though it's 10:18 at night, I'm going to address this and give it a really good answer. Those points count. I actually had a really good talk about this with my friend Chris Lopez the other day. We were playing Fort Myers, and it gave me 4 strokes, and I ended up winning. So that was solid. And we were talking about adjustments and whatnot. And I was comparing him, Taggart, to Jimbo. And Jimbo was noted for making really good adjustments. He was also noted, Jimbo that is, for his teams coming out and playing really poorly in first halves of games. If you bet against Florida State, rather, in first halves over the last couple of years, he really made it out pretty nice. Now, the thing is, Jimbo would oftentimes kind of throw things out there, right? Hey, I'm going to throw this look. I'm going to throw that look. I'm going to throw this look. I'm going to throw that look and see how the defense adjusts certain things, right? He wasn't always necessarily trying to score. He was sort of poking and prodding with the idea that he would have all the answers and be able to come back and counter and stuff. That's a strategy. It can work. It can also put you in predictable down and distance and predictable situations, but you're having to throw the ball a ton and become unbalanced because other teams now have the lead against you because you didn't score hardly any points in the first halves of games. It's also a recipe for a lack of blowouts, by the way, and having to play your starters nonstop, even in games when you shouldn't. Willie Taggart's offenses are very clearly trying to score from the first drive. They want to score points. Now, in that USF-Navy game, let me see here. He says they hit the skids in the second half. I actually don't think they did that much. But look, there is no doubt that if you score 42 points in a half, okay, guess what? Number one, that's a great job by you. Number two, the defense is probably has a ton to fix, and they probably will get some of that stuff fixed because there's some stuff you've exploited in the first half that they probably won't give up in the second half. But those points matter, and they count. It doesn't. You don't get bonus points for scoring in the second half as opposed to the first half. In fact, I'd argue that I'd rather have all my points immediately so that if the game's a blowout, I can sit my starters, in theory, obviously. It doesn't work exactly like that, but I don't think Taggart struggles to make adjustments in games. If, for instance, if they were playing Navy and they had made adjustments, right, we need to kind of get out of this mindset of adjustments, and instead we need to consider total output, right? Because if you're adjusting to something, if you're the one that's always making the big adjustments, that probably means that you have something to adjust from that wasn't working very well in the first half. By the way, here's the deal. USF got up 42-14 in that Navy game. Then they came out halfway through the third quarter. They were up 45-14. So they're up 31 points with 20 minutes left to play in the game. The game is over. They put their backups in. Navy ends up scoring 24 of the game's final 31 points. So Navy goes touchdown, 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 touchdown. Sorry, 35 points for them. USF scores one touchdown. That's all in the fourth quarter. Now, here's the deal. The final score of that game was 52-45, which seems close. You know, you want to know what the score was with 7 seconds left? 52-38. USF, or excuse me, Navy scored on the final play of that game to cut the lead to a touchdown. Then the clock went, the game was done. At no point in that game were they even remotely close to losing it. They still had a 2-touchdown lead with 2 minutes and 1 minute left. I don't see what the problem here is. I want to get out to a 28-0 lead like they did at the end of the first quarter in every single game I can play. All right? I'd rather have that and then have you try to make those adjustments and play. I want to play up. I don't want to have to play comeback ball. That's one of the things we complained about Jimbo all the time. And he was actually pretty good at it, but it's not something you necessarily want to be all that good at, right? Like, in golf, do you want to be the guy that is really good at hitting the ball off pine straw? No. You'd rather just play from the damn fairway. Now, the USF-Nebraska game, the Oregon-Nebraska game is a little bit different. I think Nebraska did make some good adjustments in that one, but USF also, or I keep saying USF, Oregon also got out to a tremendous lead in that game. At the half, they led 42-14. The game was really over. At that point, they're trying to just kind of run out the clock on that thing. They only threw 33 passes. They had 44 runs in the ballgame. If you look at the play-by-play, they're still milking some time off the clock here in the second half. They did have a fumble. They had a missed field goal, which are two kind of empty drives. They had an interception as well there. But that, I mean, honestly, man, I don't think that's the issue that people are making it out to be. Personally, I look at the total output, and I see a team that likes to jump on people early. All right, they're bombing it 3 1/4 down the middle of the fairway, and saying, "All right, good luck, catch me," you know. And I'm down with that.
I will just reiterate the most simplistic point that you made, and that if you're scoring 42 points and a half, let's not concern ourselves with too much more from that point.
What if Navy made no adjustments and USF won 84-0 against the Naval? What if they duplicated that first half? All right, Nate. Tonight, breaking news here. The Naval Academy has lost to the USF Bulls in front of 7,000 fans, 84-0. That's
no. I think you went long form on that one, and you gave a great answer. I don't have a whole lot more to add. No, your answer was more than sufficient. So.
Okay, we already answered the one about UF and Miami's schedule. What if FSU has it? Let's knock these buy or sells out, and we will, and then we'll call it a night.
All right, bud. First, buy or sell. Are you buying the idea that Florida State will have two or more losses by multiple scores? So north of 8 points? Yeah, I think it's north of, 9 or more points.
Yeah, I'm going to buy. I know some fans are going to get mad about that. I'm going to buy. I think Clemson.
So I guess the question is Clemson and who?
Well, it could be Clemson and Notre Dame. It could be Clemson and Miami, although I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. It could be Clemson and NC State. You know, this is a team that is going to have ups and downs this year. I think this team will have some phenomenal games. I also think it'll have some games where they lose, you know, considerably. Just because they have a lot of growing pains to go through. It is a new system. It is a new coaching staff. It's players getting adjusted. And it's a real bear of a schedule. If you have a little bit of an off day, you could get your doors blown off by a lot of the teams on this schedule.
I mean, I have a hard time. I certainly in my heart want to sell the idea. But, yeah, I could see Florida State. I would be shocked if they didn't lose to Clemson by 9 points or more. And there's three games that immediately come to mind, as you just mentioned, that Florida State could easily. Hell, you could, you know, you've got a murderous stretch there that theoretically you could lose three games in a row by 9 points or more. I know that's not something that Florida State fans want to hear, but we, as many people, have been banging on for a while about the difficulty of this schedule, and it didn't get, you know, with the exception of the Virginia Tech game, it's not as though it's gotten any easier over the course of the summer. So, yeah, I unfortunately am probably going to buy this idea.
All right, here we go. If Xavier Batia, I always botch pronouncing his name. If he makes those free kicks against Miami, which would have given Chris Ricks a 3-2 record against UM, would he be thought of differently? I'm going to buy hardcore that he would be thought of differently. In some ways, I don't think people care about the handicap parking permit thing so badly if you're not 0-5 against the Canes. You know, Miami is 32-30 against Florida State. Like, about a sixth of Miami's wins came at Chris Riz's expense.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And you gave Sean Taylor one or two games where he was absolutely able to cement himself as the you know, maybe the premier safety in Miami's history. So I went back and got this guy's question. He asked, and this is my fault for not clarifying. He asked, would Chris Ricks be remembered as a good quarterback? So would it affect his overall legacy? No, probably not. I mean, Chris Ricks has done a number of ridiculous things that you know, maybe the had a much more vitriolic response out of me as a late teens, early 20s than maybe looking back on it now. But Chris Ricks was one of the more polarizing players. Would it help in the fact that, that you know, one of the first things that many people associate negatively with Ricks is his games against Miami? Isn't this the game that you negate maybe one of the better single-handed performances ever as far as what Greg Jones gives you, a game in which he absolutely just runs the you know what over so many Miami players? It's there's a chance that Ricks may be slightly remembered differently, particularly with his performances against Miami. I don't know that it necessarily changes his overall impression of the program or how people associate him.
All right, hit me with the next one. What do we got?
If you change nothing about the 2017 season, nothing, not coach player buy-in, not roster composition, etc., with the rather strong exception being that Dalvin Cook is on the team, do you buy the idea that Florida State wins two or more games? Two or more games.
All right, so they were, what, 3-3 in single-score games last year? So let's assume that Dalvin would not have changed the outcome in any of the games that they lost by 8+, right? So those games were Alabama. Dalvin wouldn't have helped against Alabama, even if Francois State's healthy, I don't think. So they lost by double digits to Clemson. They got, by 17, by 17 to Alabama. By 32 to Boston College, excuse me. Do you think that they pull off two of NC State, Miami, and Louisville with Dalvin?
I would say Miami, yes, just because of what Dalvin just intrinsically had an ability to do absurd things against the team from the 305. I want to say everything positive about Dalvin Cook and what his presence would have done on the roster, but I have a hard time thinking that you win two of the three games you just mentioned.
I'm thinking about buying this simply because all three games were at home, and if you have Dalvin on that team and you have Akers, then you don't have to play Jaquez Patrick as much, and you might be able to go like super run heavy against those guys and throw the ball less. Which, of course, assumes that Jimbo would do that as opposed to being pass happy. He did like throw the ball. He was a former quarterback, if you guys recall. So, man, I'm gonna say bye.
Jaquez Patrick is not Dalvin Cook. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll have a disagreement here. Also, you can buy. It ain't gonna hurt nobody. Jaquez Patrick will never be confused with Dalvin Cook. But I would say that if you're gonna be subbing players out, there's certainly much larger value add pieces in replacement than taking Jaquez Patrick off the field at different position groups. But that's cool. We'll agree to disagree on that one. Bud, Florida State has a better chance of finishing third in the Atlantic than first. I believe there's a kind of a little bit of commonality in this podcast in the fact that we've kind of at different times mutually recognized the challenge that that going to Raleigh may be, or at least the quality of team that they have and where they might finish in the Atlantic this year.
I gotta buy this. I'll just put it simply: Florida State this year, in my opinion, is closer to NC State than it is to Clemson. If you project Clemson to be first and you project NC State to be third, or even a tie for second with FSU, then clearly I think you have to buy this idea.
Yep.
So I'm going to buy it.
Yeah, I will too. Everything you said, I will only add to that we mentioned the challenge that game has historically posed for Florida State when traveling to Raleigh, and it only becomes more of a challenge when you consider that it is wedged between two of your more prominent games of the season. So Got their hands full in general with the schedule, but particularly with the division this year. So, unfortunately, I'll probably have to say that Florida State is closer to finishing third than it is first. Final buy or sell for the evening is Dan Mullen coaches fewer than four seasons at Florida.
So if I'm buying, I'm saying that he's three or less. That would give Florida... Okay, so three or less would mean that his last year would be the 21st, 2021, right? No, 20th, 18, 19, 20. So that would mean that and Meyer's last year was 2010?
Yes, it was.
So that would give Florida four coaches in 11 years? Meyer, Muschamp, McElwain, and Mullen? No, I got to sell this. I think Mullen's going to be there for 4 years. Most importantly, because the AD Florida just hired was Mullen's boss at Mississippi State. I think that if he needs to, he will be given the chance to do some firings on his staff and bring in some different types of recruiter types, perhaps, which might not be a bad idea for the Gators. We'll have to see about that. And I think he'll be given a pretty long leash. So I'm going to go ahead and sell this. I think Dan Mullen will be there more than 3 years.
I would buy this if it wasn't for the fact that they just brought his boss over from Mississippi State. What is it, Strickland? Is that what the AD's name is? Man, it's tough. I mean, we've talked about the challenges there. We've talked about, you should screw it. I will take whatever it is that say he's not there for four full seasons. I think that, yeah, it's nice that his boss, we've talked about how that fan base is going to react, with what Georgia's doing to him. There's already a little bit of a growing concern within the fan base as far as the traction that they're having on the recruiting scene. I could just see this headed south. I could see Mullen deciding that he loves being a college football coach, but he doesn't necessarily have to be a college football coach for one of the fan bases that has one of the highest expectations in this region, and that he can go coach somewhere else in the country. So I'm actually going to make a pivot and say AD be damned and take the idea that he does not finish four full seasons.
Look at us having some disagreement time. I like that, man. Talk about
faux Scottish soccer rivals or anything else like that. So, yeah.
Oh, I watched a World Cup game. The Croatia-England game.
It was a good game. Wasn't necessarily the best one. Had a little drama. Went to extra time. And
so, can you explain this to me real quick? This defender, all right, in the I don't want to call it the end zone angle, the angle that is behind the goal, right? It clearly shows that the defender who is further away from the cross, right? So, from behind, it's the goalie's left arm, right? The defender off the goalie's left side. Is like fixing his hair.
Yeah.
Have you noticed this?
He has a brief moment there where he lets somebody through.
Well, he's like in the World Cup fun. Can you imagine if I'm trying to think of a football equivalent because you wear a helmet. Are you fixing
mouthpiece,
your gloves? And like somebody
eye
runs
black.
By you?
I saw you put that on.
Eye black. There we go. Something totally cosmetic.
Or eye black or socks. Maybe not. You're not necessarily adjusting like your shoestrings or something. You're adjusting aesthetic part of your appearance with your socks or something like that. Or maybe the guy just had a bunch of sweat and crap in his eye or something like that. But it didn't look good. I know the exact situation that you're referring to.
Are the British tabloids just killing this guy for that?
No, I think the British tabloids are so kind of in love with an unexpected run that they're at this point just kind of... now, the British tabloids will pull out the knives at some point, trust me. They get pretty nasty, particularly with they have their own set of players that they love to turn on. But for the time being, they're kind of still in the honeymoon appreciation phase.
Awesome, man. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Very cool.
July 12th, we did about who knows what the final product will look like, but we've recorded for 82 minutes on July 12th college football content, so fantastic. Appreciate it as always, bud. Good to be able to catch up with you after your travels. Thank you so much to the listener base. Some of the stats that you mentioned are just hard to wrap my mind around. Louisiana Hot Sauce has been a great partner with us. Love the pairing and be able to work with them moving forward. And a large part of that is thanks to you guys. So just want to appreciate what you guys have meant to the podcast and look forward to doing these even in the dark, gloomy nights of summer where maybe we have to stretch a little bit further to find college football related content.
Buddy, enjoyed it. 5 stars on iTunes, y'all. Appreciate it. Love our listeners, and we will be back next week.